Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, founder and CEO of Literal Humans, and I'm joined today by Paula Chiocchi, CEO of Outward Media, Inc. Welcome to the pod, Paula.
Hi, Paul. Nice to see you again.
So we're doing one of our swaps here. Paula was nice enough to host us at their office in Los Angeles when I was out there a few months ago. And yeah, it's good to have you here and good to do a swap with you.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Today, we're going to be talking about harnessing high-fidelity data for B2B growth. Obviously, it's an issue that's near and dear to our hearts at Literal Humans. So let me jump in and introduce Paula here. Paula is the founder and CEO of Outward Media, Inc., and they're a leader in B2B data and digital marketing. They provide high-quality contact data and multi-channel marketing solutions to help firms turn data into revenue. Paula is a true B2B marketing innovator. We talked to fellow marketers on the pod. She spent 27 years building the world's largest SMB database and driving hundreds of millions in revenue for Fortune 500 clients. No small feat. She's a member of Forbes Agency Council, as I used to be. I just hopped off. I wanted to take a little break.
Okay.
And is an award-winning entrepreneur known for her Zen approach to problem solving. How was that?
That was an acquired taste, becoming Zen.
I think I need a little bit of that. So maybe the fire horse year is the year to become Zen. So if you got any good stuff, send it over. So let's jump in. If you can, you know, we like to ask this first question and have you paint the picture of the landscape for our audience here. You've done a great job of changing and evolving according to the changing needs of your audience and B2B marketers over the last 27 years. You initially focused on direct mail. So I'd love to understand how that early focus on campaign accuracy shaped the DNA of the company. How did it change and evolve as you moved into the digital era?
It was quite an evolution. Well, the main thing, B2B marketing, you probably already know this, but really through audience that you developed, it's accurate. And that's the big mantra right now, is the accuracy of the data. And so as we evolved from direct mail, as digital was becoming on, early on, we were involved with just provisioning email addresses, working with a lot of the data suppliers. And then we decided to move forward and build our own database. So, and over 15 years or so, probably about since 2007, however long that is, we started building our own database and to what we call the full record data, and a focus always on the contact being matched correctly to the company with the right title, in the right functional department. And that, because if you're spending, and you know this because you buy media, if you're spending and buying media and the data is incorrect, you're not going to have a return or any ROI. So that's been a core foundation of what we do. And what we're seeing, where it's been breadth and depth of a database the last 10 years or so for digital media, now it's, okay, we're kind of shrinking the breadth and depth in terms of how big that audience needs to be, but we want it to be more accurate, more pinpointed, so we can get an ROI on for the dollars that are spent.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned ROI because it's, you know, I think your team's stated mission of turning data into revenue is a fantastic differentiator. So I'd be curious how that's landed for you. Like, how has that, stuck in the minds of your customers, and how has that truly set you apart from other providers?
Well, you know, in talking with agencies and also talking with the direct brands, I used to say to my partner, I said, you know, God, we're held to such a higher standard because we were doing what was now being called performance marketing. But back then, people were just guys saying, are you doing branding or are you doing campaigns that generate ROI? So we've always been on the ROI side and the performance sides. Now you see the market's kind of doing both, but there are also heavier emphasis on the performance marketing. And so it's like, okay, that's where we've always been. Yeah. And so that's a standard we've always been held to, and we're good at it.
I always find like the performance word, it's like so strong. It's like, no one's like a performance doctor or performance barber or something. Like, we're all trying to perform in our jobs. Yeah. Like, I get it.
Sounds more like a dance routine. Or
exactly. Yeah, you better. Yeah, get that dance. Well, we'd love to, as we move into kind of like product, you know, I'd love to talk about, you know, how you have this process of identifying B2B data as kind of like a living file, which I love. And how does this like operational philosophy of, you know, the constant automated maintenance and how does it differ from, you know, traditional kind of snapshot data licensing model and, you know, just the different approaches that your competitors might use?
So the concept of B2B a living file is we have our own data. Most companies, especially in the Fortune 2000, have maybe up to 8 or 10 suppliers for data. So one of the things we do is we help them keep that data fresh and current by doing typically monthly data cleanses. And that's when the contact drops off, they're not there anymore, or a new replacement, we get involved with replacing for those data suppliers and then also on our own data. So the concept is you're licensing of a amount of data, of contacts, and to keep it at that level and not let it attrition take over where your file is shrinking. And it can be very dynamic, as you know. You know, 2009, when the economy blew up, at least over here, you know, there was a lot of loss of jobs, et cetera. And one of the things that we did then was we kept our clients' files still at that 95% accuracy that we guarantee on the email contact, the email contact. And that wasn't easy, but we managed to conduct that. And so we feel like that's the concept of the file is just not a static delivery every month. It's the cleansing, the updating, the replacing, the sourcing and all that for our clients.
Yeah, I love that dynamism and that adaptability. Like, to talk to folks like yourself who've been around doing it for a while and just evolving, bending, flexing with your clients, but still delivering kind of what you deliver and what they need seems to be the through line. I had a specific question about the amount of data. Is the amount of data tied to, their sense of their sort of addressable market and just the total universe? They know we need to have this much. We're going to have this much. Our conversion rates. Is that sort of the thinking behind it?
I think definitely that's part of it. Typically the addressable market. And then a lot of times with the Fortune 2000 in particular, they don't have the staffing to reach out to the really small business community, right? So how can you reach them effectively? Well, online. Okay, so if you can reach them through the social channels, through email, a lot of direct mail has been cut back, okay? And one of the recommendations we've made is if you're getting a response rate on programmatic or email or social, then maybe you send a direct mail piece in to ones that are interacting with you. So yes, the addressable market, and then where do we want to put the dollars for the less profitable, shall we say, customer versus a larger customer? And I think that has trended into the social channels and programmatic and email.
I'd love to dig into this. And you kind of started to talk about this, when you mentioned the 95%, validity rate and what happened in 2009. I guess I'd like to help our audience understand what makes that email validity guarantee of 95% possible when you have this landscape of massive job shifts and data decay. I think you were maybe one of the first or the first in the industry to kind of offer this guarantee. How do you maintain that? How your folks are stepping back?
Well, how they say necessity is the mother of invention. So it was probably about 15 years ago, there was this influx of databases from all around the world, and customers, prospects were getting confused as to, well, why should I believe you that your data is any better than this company I just found out about yesterday? I thought, well, we're just going to put our money where our mouth is. We're going to guarantee you that the contact will be, for the first 30 days, accurate. And by valid, I mean you can email it. They're still at that company. So that kind of took away the objections of why should I believe you or everybody else we talked to. So that's how we came up with that. And then we just kept it today. And Paul, the funny thing is we've never had to honor it. I mean, we've never had anybody come back and say, 20% of the data wasn't good, that type of thing. So we're happy to keep promoting that. I don't think our competitors do.
Yeah, I mean the best guarantee, right, is one that you kind of never have to honor, but can always kind of meet, right? Like in terms of
exactly. So we still do it, but it's a lot of a function of a lot of. I mean, I was just looking, because I read your material before we got on here, and there's probably 15 different things minimum that we do to keep the data current. I don't even want to read you the laundry list, but there's probably at least 15 different things that go into managing that database to keep it where it is. It's not just testing the email. It's matching against social, matching IP address to URLs, all types of things. It's a process.
Yeah, perfect segue to my next question, which is in order to offer a guarantee like that, you need to have, faith in your product and how all those 15 things are the right 15 things and you can execute all those things. Walk our audience through these kind of rigorous database cleans and why, example, purging millions of records is actually kind of a competitive advantage. Yeah.
It's good. Yeah. Back when, I think it was when COVID hit, one of my friends was running a company that had a large database, and he wasn't ours. And he called me up and he said, we're having 35, 40% error rate on contacts because people were being laid off or whatever. And so we were able to assist in helping clean up the database. Just not to get too much in the weeds, but I mean, because I can't remember all of them, but I mean, we do things like company URL verification, URL to match IP verification, contact to company verification, direct phone to contact attribution. I mean, all of that. And it's a real process of multiple different points to touch to verify that that person is really where we think they are and what company they're at and what their title is. Produce a file that we license, whatever. We do all that again before we ever deliver the file.
And are these 15 criteria, are they kind of proprietary to you all, or is this like industry-wide, people are starting to check all 15 of these criteria?
From a database provider or a data provider, I'm not sure what all of them do. I think back in the day, people were just aggregating, and I don't know that there's so much today, but just aggregating a bunch of email addresses, throwing it in the database, and then licensing them, though. But that's just not good enough. We saw a lot of error rates from our clients who complained about error rates of the wrong person at the wrong company. That's a big one to make a mistake on. So I can't really vouch for the processes that any of our competitors use. I do personally think that what we do is probably deeper analysis of the record and the matching process. I do believe we go deeper.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I think there's, I always talk about product. I try to talk more about product and how as a marketer, I need to kind of humble myself. And like, if your product is just, and it sounds like your product is kind of doing the marketing for you, it just works. Go ahead.
I'll give you an example. We did a campaign, provided data for programmatic and social for an agency for a very large e-commerce company. And the feedback we got was our data set outperformed by 50% all the other data suppliers. I said, did you say 50%? I mean, I would have been happy with 10%, right? So it was pretty phenomenal. But I think it's because it's accurate. I think going into this year, and Paul, I think the mantra really is the accuracy of the contact data to build maybe not even the bigger audiences that people used to build to get to the right people. And wherever, in the right channel. I mean, because we provision it for all channels.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like, I keep hearing, obviously, about, like, ICP and you know, targeting and how that's becoming just more and more critical as we're awash in all this data and all this information. And, you know, people are just, they're distracted, they're busy, they're, you know, yeah, they're just swimming in all this stuff. And so getting through to them and making sure they're the right person to get through to becomes even more critical. So it's definitely something we're doubling down on.
Sure, you see it in your business.
Yeah, and I think there's lots of different ways to solve for it. I mean, you've got one particular highly, highly effective way. Mm-hmm. We're hearing a lot about partnerships. So we're hearing a lot about sort of human emotional level sort of connectivity and sort of branding that connects on that level. So yeah, it's exciting to see people kind of find these ways to break through. Obviously, AEO, GEO, all that stuff. So
and part of that evolution has been mapping that B2B persona all the way to what we call B2B2C now. So we've done that mapping for probably 75% of the database has been mapped to that B2C data. So that creates that, as title of your company, Literal Humans,
where
the whole human, right? I mean, you probably remember back in the day, B2B was just, we need to contact the purchasing agents. Yay.
Yeah. And I think one interesting conversation I've been getting is like how, you know, B2B is actually more emotional than B2C, right? Yeah. Because like, you know, if I buy the wrong, you know, if I buy the wrong avocado at the grocery store, okay, my partner's gonna be mad at me, but like she'll get over it. She loves me. We'll move on. But if I hire the wrong, you know, firm, or if I, you know, go through an incorrect procurement process, like my job's on the line, you know, so you have these people kind of trying to de-risk and they're like embarrassed professionally. It's their professional reputation. So I think there's a strong argument to be made to that, like B2B2C space is actually more emotional and maybe you need more of that human connectivity there as well.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And as the evolution, it's, I think, what is it, 72% of the buyers are millennials now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a lot of their, you probably already know this, but they do, 70% of the research online before they really want to talk to anybody. So you kind of need to be where they are, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, let's jump into some questions about growth, because I know it's something you think about a lot. You help your clients achieve it. And it's something you've done a great job with over the past 27 years. Feels like we're in a data crisis at the moment, and sounds like you're helping, you know, B2B firms navigate that, and unlock, you know, sustainable growth in a kind of omni-channel world. You've driven $300 million in revenue for a single client in 1 year. I mean, that's amazing. Would love to unpick some of these like growth roadblocks that a lot of companies are facing when trying to scale their data-driven marketing. What's happening out there in terms of growth roadblocks?
I think for the larger companies, again, we're talking about Fortune 2000, siloed within the company. You'll have one group doing the email, one doing the direct mail, one doing the programmatic, one doing the social, and they don't talk to each other. And so there's no cohesiveness in terms of the message across all the disciplines. I mean, you know, we have a core competency in acquisition email marketing. We've been doing that since 2007. And one of the things that we preach to them is you take the same data, you put it into the social channel, put it into the programmatic channel, and have them, you know, operating at the same time versus 1 week we're doing the social, next week we're doing the email, you know. So that I think I see some companies starting to interact better that way, but it seems like a lot of them are still siloed in terms of not communicating within their own company about what they're spending their marketing dollars are and coordinating, you know, integrating them together versus just coordinating and integrating them together.
Yeah, we see that and it blows us away. Like companies of all different sizes, like they're just, the one hand is not talking to the other. You know, we had a big Series D health tech company that we worked with who we had to beg their social media team, you know, to start putting out information that was like scientifically accurate, you know, and it was insane that we had to do that, you know, and we were working on like the blog and a content strategy. And we're just like, how is this the case, you know, in a company this big? But sometimes that makes it worse, obviously.
Well, I think that's where the C-suite comes in.
Right.
One lady that we work with, she does getting the sales, all the different in the C-suite to start communicating together effectively to bring the unified message to the marketplace. So I think you might start seeing more of that.
Yeah, that was sort of my next question. Like, it's great. Obviously, we had the great resignation and you know, B2B data took a hit. You know, in terms of the savvy C-suite execs that you've worked with out there, what are some of the strategies that, you know, the growth-minded among them are prioritizing to kind of ensure that data's strong, it's clean, and that their sales teams aren't wasting time pursuing, you know, invalid leads? So what's happening in the market?
Well, I think in the Fortune 5000, maybe it hasn't necessarily, 2000, hasn't necessarily traveled all the way up to the C-suite because we're not speaking to the C-suite, those sides of the companies. I think it used to be more leads, but you know, salespeople, they want qualified leads. They don't want more leads. They want real leads. So I think that volume driven, oh, we generated X amount of leads, is starting to get tempered to what is the quality of the lead that's coming through. And then it may be less leads, but the pull through is greater in terms of converting them into customer. And we both know that it's easier to keep a client than it is to get a new one. But once you do get them, then that journey of keeping them.
I'd be curious about like your entry point. Like, do you use the database cleansing service? Is that like a strategic entry point for clients who may be struggling?
It can be, because a lot of times within their CRM platform, there's also holes in the data they don't even know. We just finished a project where 30% of the contacts were wrong. So we had to give them the new contacts and that type of thing, because it erodes, you know, in a CRM system. And the CRM system is only good as the salesperson in putting the data. And I actually have a sales background at one point in my life. So they don't want to do that. They don't [S2] Right. [S1] Want to put their data in there. They want to go out and sell. That's what they do. So that means you should have somebody helping you refresh your CRM data and keep it up to date, which is, and then once the leads come in, get them recorded correctly as they go through the journey of nurturing [S2] Right. [S1] Them to hopefully become a client.
Nice. I'd be curious, like, I'm going to ask you about the podcast. We think of our podcast as a, you know, a bit of a marketing and growth strategy as well. Be curious, like, how does your podcast fit into that broader growth strategy to kind of establish your thought leadership and attract, you know, your target clients? And what other tools are in your growth strategy toolkit right now?
The podcast has been really good in terms of really meeting some very interesting people that are moving the needle, that people, you know, that aren't household names. And one of the things that we've done for people that have been on the podcast, and I think we offered it to you as well, is offering an email campaign or test out at no cost, okay, and the audience for programmatic or social media to execute, to try out our data. And we've been writing some really good case histories around that, in particular on the email side. They've been taking advantage of that, people that we're working with. and showing that we can move the needle. So yeah, it's been meeting interesting people. It's helped develop some clients. But some also, just like we had Dr. Fu on, I don't know if you know who he is. He's an expert in detecting fraud for programmatic. And so I think he's really timely. So we've had him on a couple of times because the fraud is worse than it's ever been in programmatic. I'm sure you're probably aware of that, which leads back to, are you going to get any ROI if the fraud's wrong? So one of the things we're doing is we're coordinating with him with our layering our data underneath his data to prove that that contact is real. We're just beginning to do that now for the programmatic side of the business.
Really so interesting.
We haven't launched it yet. We're just piecing it together now, but we're excited about that. That's going to drive more revenue for people because you know, you have an agency, the bots. You know, the bots are taking probably 50% of the programmatic isn't real.
Yeah, one of our biggest client, they're a programmatic ad tech agency. You know, it's something I'd love to chat with you more about. But yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, they obviously saw like, you know, a huge shift in their revenue in the past couple of years, mm-hmm. partly because of this situation. Yeah, I would love to talk with you about how do we get them. Sure. And they're mostly targeting agencies, other agencies. Sure. So it might be an interesting test case to try like this email campaign. Sure. And we're already doing stuff with like, you know, their nurture sequences, all this stuff. So we should talk mm-hmm. about that.
Sure.
Offline.
So we're just really trying to find people that are doing things that are unique, different, and share them through our social channels and our audience, just like you do with your podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'd love to like jump into kind of you as a leader, as a human, as a literal human.
I love the name of your company.
We try. It's helping us in the AI age, that's for sure.
Especially with the AI going on, where they're not humans.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, we'd love to like dig in. Like you mentioned kind of a passion for Asian art, for example. You've got this beautiful office. I was there myself. It was incredible to see all the art. And you do great stuff when it comes to mentorship as well, which I love. I come from an education background. We'd love to understand like how that's, you know, elevated and influenced your leadership style today. And how does that help you kind of stay balanced in the challenging world of B2B marketing?
Well, I've had over the years, a number of people leave to start their own businesses, which to me was a compliment that they felt like they could become an entrepreneur, you know, having worked as being. And I've mentored a few of them as well. And people say, well, aren't you upset they left? No. I said, because in particular, I had one young, I said, you should go do it. I said, you don't want to wake up and be 80 years old and say, I didn't try, right? I should have done it. So, because you can always do something else if it doesn't work out, right? So I'm very big on promoting people that are working or giving advice to or mentoring people that are trying their journey into entrepreneurship because I'm passionate about it. And when I was 12, 13 years old, that's what I told my parents I was going to do. I said I was going to be a president of a company one day. I'm not getting married, I'm going to be a president of a company. Well, I did get married, but then another story, got divorced. But anyway, I did start the companies. And I have even, you know, it's up and down sometimes, right, running a business, but I have enjoyed every minute of it. And I think anybody that has a passion for that should go for it. And I talk to people regularly online to help them in their journey.
Yeah. Yeah. I've just started doing some myself. We have, you know, interns that we bring on, but also there was a cohort of young agency owners that have started up, you know, recently, and they brought me in to kind of work with a couple of them. It's like, it's just so cool to like teach lessons that you've learned time and time again over and over. So yeah, I appreciate it.
You shortcut them. You can shortcut for the mistakes, you know, because we've all made them, right? Running a business. So you can kind of help them shortcut some of those and be up and running faster and hopefully profitable faster.
Yeah. It's so gratifying. Last couple of minutes here, I want to take us through the quick fire questions. It's kind of a fun way for us to get to know you. And so I'm going to hold you to the first thought that comes to your mind, you know, as I ask the question, and then maybe like a sentence or two just explaining yourself. But if you could found another company, another startup, what would it be and why?
Well, I don't know, because I did see that question ahead of time, but I definitely...
You can also pass.
Well, we're using AI now in the business pretty heavily. So I don't want to focus on that because I think, to be honest with you, my next iteration would be not nonprofit.
Oh,
to be
amazing.
Honest with you. Yeah. I think that's what eventually I'd like to do is be on the nonprofit side because I think I could help drive value, especially for raising money.
Absolutely. I'm sure you're excellent at that.
Yeah. So I didn't answer question that you asked, because I'm not sure that I would, you know, it would, again, I'm already using AI, or we already using AI, so
No, you did. You did. Another gentleman we're going to have on the podcast soon. He just built a tool to help nonprofits connect with funders in a sort of leaner, focused way. So happy to connect you with him. And maybe there's a there. He's used to work at Google and used to run their philanthropic arm. So he's like the perfect person for.
We should speak. Maybe there's some stuff we can do to support him.
Yeah. Happy to connect you.
I think it's a topic.
Especially these days. They're doing a lot for folks that, you know, like other parts of the system are not doing. So we'll just leave it at that. Kind of a two-sided question. What's a tech invention that makes you the most excited and also, you know, a tech invention that makes you the most concerned right now?
They're one and the same. The AI. See, for me, one of the articles I've been reading is just talking about CEOs of companies. What they want is they want the AI to make their people that work with them more efficient. If you can increase their efficiency 25%, whatever that magic number is, then they have more time to work on using critical thinking for other parts of the business, you know, and not get bogged down into that, I don't want to say menial, but, you know, the day-to-day things that need to get done. We're doing it here, you know, and it's really helped. But at the same time, you know, all the articles I read, it's kind of scary at the same time, you know, because it's moving a lot faster than people anticipated. And you have part of the camp saying, oh, you know, everything's gonna be fine. The other part saying, no, they're actually, AI is going to end up becoming more human and maybe turn around on us. So I don't know.
I think it's
good and scary at the same time.
It's moving way
faster than I think any of us thought.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's the most popular answer to those questions, and usually it's both sides, but
you didn't want to be boring and be the same.
No. Just like it shows the level of interest and salience. So flipping to the human side, who's a human that you want to shout out who's been integral to your career journey?
Well, I belong to, I don't know if you're familiar because I know you're across the pond, but I belong to a group here in the country called, U.S., called Vistage International. And it's a CEO groups that meet across the country. And I've been in my group for over 20 years. And my coach, Alain Athenin-Gerard, has been very instrumental sometimes when, you know, the old saying, when you can't see the forest for the trees, you know, I should have thought of that, you know, so I meet with him once a month, one-on-one, and he's helped shape a lot of things in running this business. And then we have a group meeting. So I would say probably Alain.
That's amazing. Yeah. I'd love to hear more about this. I've heard some good things. So
They have him in the UK.
I've definitely heard their name rings out. So that's a good sign. And then leave us with an inspirational quote, if you can, something that's maybe stuck with your journey in B2B marketing.
Time ago, I read it, I can't remember. And it's on a board here. Silence in a meeting means agreement. And so what I've told the people that have worked for me over the years is if you don't speak up, you know, and say what's on your mind, then I'm going to just assume that you agree with everything we're doing. And I've fostered a culture where people can say what's on their mind. Now, I may not agree with it. And at the end of the day, obviously, as owners of our companies, of our businesses, that we make the final decision. But I think that you do need input, and you do need input from even different age groups, you know, because, you know, the millennials, Gen Z, my nephews, you know, they know a lot more stuff than I do. So, you know, to be able to blend all that together is important if you're going to stay ahead of the game and keep, you know, as owners of CEOs of our businesses, part of our job is vision, right? You know, in 6 months out, a year out, 5 years out, you know, if 5 years is probably too long now. But that's one of the things that we need to be doing. And if we're not listening to people, then it's not going to happen. And that's why I have that on a board over there. Silence means agreement. So if you don't agree, speak up.
And also, like, how you know, it's so important to be getting that real talk from your team. And even though there's a power differential, like, you know, just getting... what's happening on the ground? What's happening with clients? So you can make those decisions.
Yes.
Yeah. So I really agree with that. Appreciate that. Well, listen, Paul, I love this episode. I think your work, you know, reminds us that behind all these big successful, you know, companies, Fortune 2000, all this stuff is a foundation of like humans and tech that are verifying the data sets that they're working off of and making them high quality so that they can sell and serve clients. And I think people look past that too much. So I think you provide a critical service and a big fan of what you do. Also, you have this great ability to blend that Zen perspective, but also you're working in this high stakes world of B2B marketing, and it's inspiring. So keep coming with that energy.
Thank you.
Of course. So thank you for joining us. Please let our listeners know, where can they find out more about your work and Outward Media Inc.?
Our website is outwardmedia.com, and I am on LinkedIn, obviously. Actually, email is paul@outwardmedia.com. I love to hear from people.
Nice. And check out Paula on the Forbes Agency Council and on LinkedIn. We'll include all those links in the episode description. And yes, to our audience, thank you again for listening. Another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. We've been talking today with Paula Keoki, the CEO of Outward Media, about harnessing high fidelity data for B2B growth. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us. Give us a review, give us a 5-star rating so we can keep bringing amazing CEOs like Paula onto the show. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Paula.
Thank you, Paul.